Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, a Canadian special with a bit of Swedish mixed in. We'll be welcoming back writer and philosopher John Ralston Saul. The Canadian intellectual will be telling us why the world looks the way it does and what globalisation has had to do with it.
We'll also be saying hello again to the Swedish film director, Ruben Östlund. He was last here to discuss his darkly comic hit, Force Majeure, and we'll be hearing about his equally off-kilter new follow-up, The Square, a little later.
And we'll be discussing the best in Canadian music and who's up for a gong at tonight's Juno Awards in Vancouver. DJ and music journalist Lana Gay will be giving us some tips at the end of the show.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be placing his own bets for next week's news. And that is all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, here we are. It feels like the start of a new era. We're bright, we're fresh, we're in the smaller confines of Studio 2. Someone has seen fit to turn the heating on here for once.
Shall we cast our bloodshot eyes towards next week's news?
Yes, let's do it. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando. That's why Alan Partridge's son is called Fernando, isn't it? Really?
That is.
I'm sorry, Fernando.
It's fine. I had to Google Alan Partridge very recently.
And welcome to the news look ahead seat, Fernando.
I'm very excited to be here.
Beautiful to have you here. What is going to happen next week?
We have to start with a serious one. And, you know, of course, elections, I think it'll be a very important year. We have elections in several countries, including my own Brazil later this year. But the Egyptians are voting for their new president between Monday and Wednesday. That's quite unusual, a country that, you know, have like about 3 days to vote. But if the thing here, let's be honest, guys, it's not going to be a surprise. The incumbent president will win. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, I mean, he won the election in 2014 with 97% of the vote.
People love him.
Even Putin only got 76%.
And there's been problems. I've been reading about it because he only has like one candidate against him with a fantastic name here, Mossa Mustafa Mossa. But the thing is, I was reading more about him and he was pro-Sisi. So some people are saying that he's just there as a puppet. There's been other challenges as well, but some of them had to be, you know, deported to different countries. Some of them were in jail. So it is a bit of a difficult situation there as well. And it's funny because they say the Egyptian presidential system has like two rounds, but, you know, to be honest, I don't think we're going to need a second round.
We're not going to need a second round.
My second story, a Formula One. Are you fans? I mean, be honest.
I am a fan, yeah.
I still kind of keep a weather eye. I used to be, when I was a kid, really into it. But it was different then, when you had
Senna, Mansell,
Senna,
PK, Prost.
Yeah. I mean, well, Brazil. How many Brazilian world champions within a 10-15-year period? That was the golden age for me.
There is a little bit of a Brazilian angle here. But first of all, I have to say that today was the first Grand Prix of the year in Melbourne. And there's been quite a little curiosities about this year's Formula One. For example, we're going to have 21 races. That's the record number of races. It actually is tied in with 2016. So some of the pilots are saying that, you know, it's actually too much, even though apparently there's some rumors they want to increase to 25 races.
Yeah.
I mean, that'll be a bit too much. For example, around June, July, I think there'll be like consecutive races, like in different countries.
I mean, that's true. You have to think, if someone like, you know, an Alonso, you know, he's struggling to get by on £30 million a year. I mean, expecting him to be at almost £1 million per working day. I mean, you've got to have some sympathy.
These poor boys.
But I was going to say the Brazilian angle here is the first time in 49 years that we don't have Brazilian pilots this season.
Yeah, right.
And it's a big shame as well because it's Brazil's a very important market to the Formula One. So, you know, I was reading a lot of the sports commentary in Brazil. They're saying that, you know, unfortunately we didn't like groom new pilots for the season.
Why has this happened, Faye? With this rich heritage we were alluding to?
I think it's a big shame. And, you know, I was asking if you're a fan. To be honest, I used to be, of course, when Senna was there, even Barrichello and, I mean, Felipe Massa more or less. But there's another problem here. I was looking at the list of pilots. Most of them are Europeans. We just have like four pilots that are from non-European countries. We have one Australian, one Mexican, one Canadian, and one Kiwi. and that's it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the races are all over the place, like in Bahrain, in China, Azerbaijan. So I think I would like to see the
list
of...
International outreach.
Exactly.
Yeah, you kind of feel there'll be... Yeah, there can't not be a Brazilian driver for too many years on a trot. I kind of feel there must be a Chinese driver. You kind of feel that the Middle East is so powerful in Formula One now that there must be a Middle Eastern driver. But then they obviously have to make their way up. There used to be this thing that happened in the 80s when you used to get a Japanese driver that used to come with the Honda engine, and it used to be there. It used to have Satoru Nakajima and Agaro Suzuki and all these people that would have to kind of be dropped into the seat, and they'd drive alongside Senna. So Senna's teammate was Nakajima, and you've got this maybe the best driver of in history, or certainly of his generation, and then this chap which was probably muddling along in like Formula 3.
A free gift.
You
still have now drivers who are almost like privateers. They come because they have endorsements from private companies.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you say, I'm Robert Bound and I'm sponsored by, you know, Google, and I bring £20 million worth of investment, then you get the drive, come what may. But we need to see... Isn't there Nelson Piquet Jr. or someone?
Yeah,
there is one, but I think the closest one we have is a pilot. I think his name is Sergio Sette.
Yeah.
But you know, he's still very young. He's like 18. So I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Watch Hopefully. This space,
guys. Final story. I think it's a pretty obvious one. Friday is going to be Good Friday, Easter time, and I decided to talk a little bit about Easter eggs,
okay.
Which I love, by the way.
Yep.
But I was a bit annoyed. Of course, everybody knows Dominique Ancel, the chef who created the Cronut. And one of his, he's going to start selling the Wevocado. You know, and as you guys probably know, I hate avocados. But, you know, it's going to be on sale, I think, until the 1st of April.
Is this already sold out? Is this famous?
Probably by now it will be sold out, actually.
Just because our listeners can't see this. This looks like an avocado cut in half with the stone still in it. But you're telling me this is all chocolate components?
It's all chocolate components. But
heaven's alive.
But it does look incredibly like an avocado. And apparently there'll be some mini, white chocolate eggs inside as well.
Fernando Garcia Pacheco, thank you very much indeed for the news look ahead.
Happy Easter.
We last heard from Canadian writer and philosopher John Ralston Saul on the Monocle Weekly around 3 years ago. He discussed the importance of freedom of expression following the attacks on French satirical title Charlie Hebdo. Saul's ideas about political and economic issues have made him one of the most sought-after modern thinkers. And from 2009 to 2015, he was president of Penn International, the organisation representing intelligent writing around the globe.
He joins us again today to talk about his book, The Collapse of Globalism, which first appeared in the early 2000s. It's been updated to address some of the more recent issues of our time, populism, Trump, Brexit, and more. He joins us on the line from Paris. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, John. Thank you very much for joining us today. Now, The Collapse of Globalism, it's been recently updated, your book. What on earth could be the matter with the world for you to need to reissue your book right now?
You know, the funny thing is that it keeps coming out new editions, and the new British edition is coming at the same time as the Turkish and the Greek. So it was really fascinating because as I redid, this prologue and epilogue and changed things in the text, I had... You know, Greece, catastrophe of all time, Turkey, you know, just getting worse and worse, and Britain. And so it was a very interesting way of not slipping into a sort of, you know, narrow national way of looking at what's happening today.
And John, if we can look at that then, these moments of sort of localized crisis on a geographic basis, but they seem to contribute to this broader narrative that you've been tracking for, 20 years or more about a crisis in globalization. But I wonder, is that helpful if we're looking at that in a sort of diagnostic way? Or is it more actually instructive to go right back to where you see the origin story of globalization, really, and find the implicit weaknesses in it, going right back to the sort of early 1970s?
To the 70s. I think, you know, your original question, why does one need to keep doing this? Well, the answer is that, what are we going to call them? The governing elites, whether they're economists or commentators in newspapers or civil servants or... departments in universities really have not fundamentally changed. Certainly, you know, after 2008, they had every reason to change, and they're still saying and teaching the same thing. And I mean, I think only yesterday I saw in the Financial Times Martin Wolf, who just can't bring himself to admit that he's been wrong over the years. So now he's sort of acting as if you know, he's quoting various people who've been warning over the years, but without actually dealing with why he got it so wrong for so long. And you see, if you don't go back, as you say, to 1973 and understand how the choices were made, how the wrong direction was taken, then you won't know how to get out of it. You won't know what to do next. You are that, it's that old thing, you know, without history, you're a child. And we're acting like children.
Now, we'll come on to some of the new sections of the book, John, in just a second. But let's focus on that. You gave us a year, 1973. Tom was talking about the early 70s. What was it? What was the sea change? What was the thing that did or didn't happen then that we need to go back and revisit in order to be able to pull our trousers up in 2018?
Well, you know, the Keynesians had been more or less in power, since the big collapse in the 30s. And so there was a first wave of Keynesianism, and then there was a second wave during the war, and then a third wave after the war. So, you know, that's a very long run for an economic theory without any kind of questioning. And, you know, everybody basically bought into it, or most people did. And then you had what people thought was an oil crisis in the 70s, and, you know, high inflation and high interest rates and all that. But people, just as today people are caught on very specific things, then they were very caught on, you know, the oil crisis. And they didn't really try to look at what had gone wrong. And the elites in place were basically had been doing the same thing for so long. They didn't know what to do that was new. This left a vacuum, an enormous vacuum. And as I say, in a crisis, you get like this, you get a big vacuum, and then you've got 5, maximum 10 years to get your act together, to come up with a new way of handling it. You have to be very conscious about what you're doing. Because if you're not, you're basically, you know, you're not acting, you're reacting. And of course, you know, in the 70s, they didn't deal with the crisis. And so power fell into the hands of this incredibly marginal and pretty mediocre group who were people who followed the Austrian-American, theoretically economist Hayek, very peculiar marginal figure who adored the class system and, you know, didn't believe in copyright and so on and so on, very out of it. And suddenly, you know, the Western world, thanks to a bunch of second-rate economists who followed him, were building this thing called globalization as if it were brand new, when in fact it was nothing more than harking back to various bits and pieces of the middle of the 19th century, most of them actually from England. So it was very odd that you would find the new way out by throwing yourself into the hands of mid-19th century Britain, which is what they did, you know.
And John, let me ask you about then what should or what could fill the vacuum maybe that is currently settled over things. And if it's an ideological shift, does it or can it be purely economic in character in terms of the new thing that could help us move forwards and get us out of this bind? Or does it need to be more complex? And I guess it would be perfectly reasonable if you would say, look, you know, this book and my writing on this area is not supposed to be prescriptive in that way. But what kinds of things should we be looking out for and trying to encourage to get us out of the mire?
Well, first of all, you know, I think we missed the deadline. You know, so people like me were saying, you've got 5 to 10 years. And I started saying that, as you know, in 2005 with the book when it first came out. And then 2008 hit. And I was saying in 2005 that the crisis really started around 2001. So, you know, by 2008, you know, Best Buy date had come and gone. And so really since then, we've been in reaction. You know, in other words, the whole thing caved in on us. And there hasn't been new activity. And even sort of reasonably interesting new governments, say in France or in Canada, their economic policies are pretty well just copies of what we've been doing for the last half century. So we're in a very, very reactive or denial mode. I mean, some are in extreme denial, like the United States, but, you know, or Britain, which is in, you know, a kind of crazed denial. I mean, it's another subject, but it's a sort of denial of what's going on out there. Just, you know, as one of the things to come out of the collapse of globalism has been the return of regional power structures, that's what the Russians are after, that's what the Americans are after, that's what the Chinese are after. It's a very, very odd time for, you know, a country with a not large population like Britain to say, we're going to go on our own and we'll find lots of friends. Well, the friends are all going into regional blocks. And those blocks are going to have walls around them. And, you know, Europe's going to be one of those blocks. So it's very bad timing in terms of the future. But, you know, I think that it isn't fundamentally an economic problem. It's fundamentally an imaginative problem. It's how you imagine things. I mean, most of the stuff that went wrong in the 90s and the early 20th century were things that were in perfect public view. Everybody could see what was happening in banking or in the housing market or in the speculation markets, and they just chose not to see it. It was there. It was perfectly visible. So a lot of it has to do with how you imagine what can be done, how you can handle things. I mean, is technology really in charge? Does privacy no longer have any power? Do we have the power to break up corporations, which is what you do in order to have a reasonable marketplace, whether you're on the left or the right? And people are not yet convinced that one of the first things you have to do is break up the monopolies and oligopolies which reappeared under globalization. That's not an economic decision. That's an imaginative, political, social, democratic decision that we're just going to look at Google and say, you know, well, that'll be about five pieces. Facebook, well, we maybe six pieces, you know, and just break them up and put very strict regulations in at the national, regional, and international level. And then you'll get a very different picture the moment you bring in those kinds of controls. I mean, I think the other thing you have to do is you have to very, very seriously look at what's being taught in universities, because that's what produces the people who produce the policies, and realize that there are enormous reforms that have to take place, particularly in the social sciences, in economics, the business schools, catastrophic. Absolutely catastrophic what they're teaching, but even political science. And they have to be rethinking what they're saying about how societies work, because they're not helping the kids. And I think that's another thing, is that you know, we're sort of plunging on in this reactive way without, there's a bit of talk about new intelligence and artificial intelligence and so on. But actually, I don't know anybody in power anywhere or a high official who's thinking seriously about how kids are going to have jobs and have lives in 10 years or 20 years.
John, I wanted to ask you about populism, which is something that you obviously address, especially in the updated parts of your book as well. Do they come from market forces, the misunderstood market forces, the misunderstood economy and notions of globalism? Do you know where that comes from? Is that a reflection of this fragmented, regionalizing with walls round, as you said, world that we're going to be living in?
Well, populism is entirely an outcome. It's not a cause at all. It's an outcome. And, you know, for myself, I started writing about the return of populism in Vulture's Bastards in 1993. You could see it. And I wrote about it clearly in 95, and I wrote about it in 2000, and I wrote about it in 2005. I mean, it has been coming very slowly but gradually, along with things like racism becoming respectable again. And, you know, in the collapse of globalism, I started trying to help people by saying, look, the elites in particular, don't simply reject nationalism. Talk about, for example, positive nationalism versus negative nationalism. Negative nationalism is the stuff that produces racism and populism and so on, whereas positive nationalism is the idea people belong somewhere and they're citizens and that democracy is based on citizenship. So, you know, populism comes, yes, it comes out of the failure of this economic ideology of the last half century, but that really comes out of an attitude inside the elite structures, which is slightly different in each country. Elite structures in which people were, you know, very utilitarian, very narrowly rational, and they stopped believing that citizens were real people. They started talking about citizens as clients. They started talking about having, you could only have meeting with interested parties. You don't have meetings with citizens. They stopped thinking about how democracy worked and started thinking about interest groups, basically an old... They basically started acting as if we were in a kind of Mussolinian society without the uniforms, you know, which is corporatism. It's where it comes from. And so that sense of isolation, which large parts of the population feel, was created entirely by the center-right, center-left, who simply forgot how to have a proper and normal conversation with citizens. And that was partly tied to their belief from the 70s on that globalization was inevitable. That as soon as, you know, people in government think that big things are inevitable, you've cut yourself off from the citizenry, and the citizenry get more and more upset as they're isolated and not being listened to, not being involved, and it ends up in populism at the end of the line. It's like, it's as if they've sent a series of warnings over the last 25 years in elections and all sorts of ways. And frankly, whether it's, you know, the last conservative government in Britain or liberal governments in Canada or, you know, two democratic governments in the United States as well as Republican governments, they all ignored this. So in the end of the day, you start getting not the final message, let's call it the maybe the second last message, which is to start sending loonies into public office. Or difficult, really, really difficult, crazy people. And because they will pretend to be speaking for the people, which at least is better from a certain point of view than people who won't listen to the population at all or won't work with the population at all.
John, I was just going to ask you, you know, we're generally an optimistic bunch at Monocle, despite, and it's quite hard hearing from some of what you say. Where can we look then to see the expression of that optimism? Is it about looking for isolated examples where politically this trend has been bucked? Is it about saying, look, I can still find, you know, whether it's a political ideology or a sociological ideology or an economic ideology that does deliver or that offers at least the opportunity to live the kind of progress you're talking about? Where do you find the expressions of optimism?
Well, first of all, I think you're seeing, it's not really the NGOs. I think they're in a bit of a trap, but, you know, in sort of fighting directly their enemies, so to speak. But I think you're increasingly seeing new generations refusing to go along with what I've been describing and what's described in the collapse of globalism. You can see it in Spain, this sort of, you can see it in Greece. You can see it in the followers of Sanders in the United States. You can see increasingly people under 30 and often under 25 just saying, this doesn't have anything to do with me. This doesn't work for me. I'm not going to go down this road in any way. And they're trying to work out what road they can go down. And I think we don't know what shape that's going to take, but I think it's possible that there's something, you know, that they have the most, they are the most concerned in a way, and that they are going to make life very, very uncomfortable, not only for the old sort of liberal conservative elites, but they will eventually make things very uncomfortable for the populace. So I think that, you know, the big hope, it's not about the big hope lies with young people, it's that the young people are now in a position where they can see that they're going to live to be 100 and they're surrounded by elites who haven't thought even about how to employ them up to the age of 50. Or help them get employed up to the age of 50, let alone how they're going to live from 50 to 100. So there's a real interesting anger that's expressing itself. A lot of it in places like Britain and Canada and Germany, it's being expressed for the moment in social areas. So in areas that, say, have to do with racism or that have to do with gender definitions. And you say, well, what's that got to do with it? Well, these are areas where younger people feel they can get at a problem. But I think pretty soon that's going to expand into far, if you like, into the other issues, the political issues, the economic issues, the social issues. So I, you know, I have great, you know, confidence in that. I think that's quite interesting. I mean, also the one of the curious things about having governments like the Trump government is that, you know, people who don't agree, even though they may have voted for them and are angry in that way, start to see that, you know, we have to find a completely different route. I mean, that's what you're sort of seeing with these young people on the gun issue in the southern United States. I mean, you know, that conversation between a student and Senator Rubio, I don't know if you saw it or not, on stage in front of people a couple of weeks ago was astonishing. where the student just said, "Senator, will you now today," it was right after the last massacre, "will you now today promise that you will not take any money from the Gun Association, NRA? And he couldn't bring himself to say it. And, you know, became a laughingstock of a whole generation. So I think that this is happening in a kind of unruly way, and it's different in every country. So you can't exactly predict what it's going to look like, but it's happening.
I wonder how you see, you sort of talked about Rubio there on stage being kind of being trussed up like a chicken, John, by you know an ordinary person. What about accountability? You open your book with that Greenspan quote, Alan Greenspan going, you know, "I don't really know what went on, what happened." Or, "I don't know why it happened," I think he says. Is that the problem? That actually maybe things, the world seems to move so much faster. Our communications, our understanding of things is so much more surface level than maybe it used to be. Or maybe we're looking at the past through rose-tinted spectacles. But does there need to be some accountability? And in what form might that take?
Well, so you see, I think the first thing that's really interesting is that there are moments when you have relatively interesting leadership on average who stand up to the ideologies. And what's fascinating is after 1973 is that you got people like Greenspan who were deeply, deeply mediocre. And even people like Mervyn King in Britain, I mean, you know, was totally wrong all the way through. He's still trying to justify his errors without admitting how wrong he was. And so, you know, when the crisis comes, they don't know what hit them because they were actually, drinking the Kool-Aid, or, you know, they didn't have the brains or the independence of spirit to ask the questions that, you know, over the years, I just had endless conversations with ministers and officials saying, "Well, why don't you try this or why don't you try that?" You know, and they would look at you confused because they were terrified by the idea that they would become non-conforming. And so, you know, I think that that's the first thing, that it has not been an interesting time. It's been a bit like the time after the Napoleonic Wars, when the sort of mediocre spokespeople of the old aristocracy got power until 1848. And it was a very, you know, people made money in the marketplace, certain individuals, but it was a very mediocre period. And that's what we've, frankly, been through, you know. And so it's going to require a certain cleaning out. And I'm not a believer in, you know, we need to guillotine people. But I do think that you can't make the changes unless there's a clear identification of wrongs done. You know, you have to be able to blame people in order to understand the change of direction that's required. And that's why someone like me, you know, is very, very clear that, you know, I think Greenspan was an idiot. I don't think he was wrong. I think he was an idiot. King was living a delusion, you know, and he can't admit that. You know, our newspapers are filled with Friedman in the United States, you know, who wrote his book about the world was flat. He was 100% wrong. He was wrong. In a just world, he would be fired. You look at governments and there's a minister here and a minister there, and you say, "Oh, well, you know, this person made a decent little effort, and there were little efforts by a couple of people in Italy, and, you know, and there's some efforts made in Norway, and there's some very interesting things done in Iceland at the time of the collapse when they basically said they would refuse to repay Britain, remember? And that was a sign of intelligence. That was really good. And, you know, you could go through and you could pick all these people out. There's a nice long list of them. But, you know, there have always been interesting opponents of ideologies. It's the moment when the ideology is broken, which you're waiting for, and then you have to leap and you have to have major changes in direction. Certainly, you know, the new president of France is making a major effort in a bunch of areas. It's what's too bad is that his economic policies are not really a break with this past. It's too bad. And although, you know, Mrs. Merkel has been very interesting in many ways and very good in many ways, I mean, great on refugees, for example, she fell into the trap of a kind of artificial stability in economics, which really has not been helpful. And she was really in a position to help people come around a corner. And instead of that, it's been a very, very, let's not move too fast. Let's not do anything unexpected. And at a time when that was really required.
Thank you very much indeed, John. And the new edition of The Collapse of Globalism is out now, published by Atlantic Books. You're with the Monocle Weekly. Now, we're going to be discussing the best of Canadian music at the end of the show. So, should we get a head start on that right now?
Let's dive straight in, Tom.
This is Calgary's Preoccupations with Disarray.
Preoccupations there with Disarray.
You're with the Monocle Weekly. Swedish film director Ruben Östlund created the squirmingly awkward triumph that was Force Majeure back in 2014. The film depicted a father who bolts on sight of an avalanche during a family skiing trip, leaving said family to fend for themselves, only for the catastrophe to pass them by, leaving everyone unharmed. And a pretty difficult conversation to follow.
His new film, The Square, asks similarly uncomfortable questions about human nature, skewering not only the contemporary art world, which central character Christian inhabits, but also notions of male privilege and entitlement too. Monocle's Gaia Lutz met Ruben recently to talk about it, and she began by asking whether contemporary art today really holds sway over so much of society.
Well, I definitely think it has that possibility to be something where we can discuss what it is to be a human being and what we should do with society and bring up important topics of our time. But, I mean, you have to look critical on every certain kind of area that you are working with. You could just as well aim the camera towards the movie industry and talk critical about what they are doing, or the journalists that are in news media, etc., etc. But one thing that I really think is a problem when you look at the art world today is that if you go to many contemporary art museums, as I did when I was doing the research, you will see pretty much the same things on this wall, like a neon sign on the wall saying something, I don't know what, a couple of objects on the floor. But at the same time, of course, there's very interesting art going on also. But a lot of the art world now is so connected with economy. So it's rather economy that is the goal with like collecting these art pieces rather than saying something interesting on what's going on the outside of the walls of the museum. I think we also have to look back at the history of contemporary art, and like when Duchamp put the pissoir into the white cube, then it was a provocation towards that room. He wanted to ask himself and the environment, what are we doing with this room? What is art? But now they are trying to, it's very often they do that kind of provocation over and over again, and it really doesn't provocate anyone anymore.
The film seems to comment on not only the art world, but maybe also Swedish society, or perhaps any other first world society. Problems people have in communicating to people who they feel are different from them. There's a lot of bystander apathy in the movie. Where do you think we stand, not only in Sweden, but in any big society or metropolis on that issue?
Well, I think that I was aiming quite much on the Scandinavian society, but maybe it's pointing out something about our time in general. What I think that have happened in Sweden that have been like a country where we put a lot of trust in the state, suddenly we have become more and more individualistic. And I thought it was interesting, you know, when they were opening the borders of European Union and suddenly it was beggars coming from Romania to Sweden. We had very mixed emotions about this. Not that they should be thrown out, but who should take care of the problem? Is it the state that should take care of the problem, or is it me as an individual? And if you look at the Swedish society, I think that one good thing before have been that we really put a lot of trust in the state and that we are dealing with things as a collective together. So what happened now was like that instead of talking about should we raise the tax with 0.01% and then deal with this problem together, the guilt on how we should deal with the beggars was put down onto an individual level. So I should ask myself, am I a good person or not a good person? Do I give this beggar or why don't I give this beggar? And for me, it's really naive to think that you can solve a problem that is a structured problem in society on an individual level like that. But still, this was the thing that you were discussing in media instead of, come on, let's deal with this problem together. And for me, it points out quite much about the time that we are living in, you know, that we are bringing down topics that is actually about regulations, for example, when it comes to environmental problems and when it comes to like economical unbalance. We bring these topics down to an individual level, and we will never be able to solve it if we look at it as individual problems.
But you also point towards personal challenges with individuals in your films too. The main character, Christian, and his comfort zone and the problems he has in engaging with someone from a different background than his. Do you think that's a problem we should overcome individually too?
Yes, I agree that there's like two ways of looking at morale and ethics. Of course, it's an individual level also. This is, of course, in much more practical way. And then I think that's where this behavioristic perspective comes into the film, you know, highlighting that human being is a bystander. We are a herd animal, and that's why the bystander effect is very strong on us, that we get paralyzed because it's like, don't take me, take someone else instead. But these are actually the two levels of the film, I would say. Responsibility on a society level and responsibility on an individual level. But one very important thing for me when I was doing the film is that I have to identify with everything what Christian does. Am I able to do the same thing? So I really don't want him to make him like a cliché racist or a cliché good person or whatever. I really wanted to like look at myself and think, would I be able to do these things he does now? And then change the setup so I actually can say, yeah, no, it is. I could do the same thing, you know.
I wanted to ask you also about your sense of humor, because I found the movie very funny, but, you know, funny in an unusual way. A lot of like anxious laughs and awkward silences coming out. You have a scene with a chimp doing art and another scene that's a character that's a man impersonating a chimp as a piece of art. What are you trying to say about human nature?
The first thing was about the humor and like the awkward humor that I think I really think is universal, you know, that human being is a social animal. You know, we are really, really sensitive when it comes to social situations. And for an example, the eye on a human being, we have a lot of white part on the left and right side of the eye. And that makes it possible for us to see exactly where someone is looking. So we can detect if someone is looking at you or looking at someone else very easily because of the how our eye is looking and the color of the eye. So social awkwardness is, of course, connected to that we are a herd animal and that we are constantly like detecting where is my position in this group. You know, awkwardness, when you're experiencing it in a movie, you can compare it when you are looking at violence in a movie because it triggers parts of your brain and you get a secondary effect of an adrenaline rush almost. Oh my God, I don't have to participate in this, but I can still enjoy looking at it because I'm scared of it. So it's almost like a horror movie. And yeah, if you look at the word awkward, it's one of the most Googled words if you look at the Google statistics.
Was there any symbolism with using the chimp specifically though?
I had an idea what the chimp should draw, but I wanted to draw thunderstorm and knives. That's what I wanted it to draw, but we didn't manage. He could only do this very simple patterns. Since I'm like looking at human being from a behavioristic perspective quite much in my movies, I think it's important to not forget that human being is an animal. I think that human beings seem to be so ashamed of our instinct and needs. And one reason that I think that we love looking at monkeys is because we are looking at a mirror of ourselves, but where we have addressed away the civilized side, or the so to speak civilized side. And what we have left is an animal with instinct and needs. Of course, those instinct and needs that we are trying to control, that we are trying to push down, is really influencing our behavior in so many ways when it comes to sexuality and when it comes to survival. And we can't forget those instinct and needs if we are trying to understand human being. That's why we not only can say, well, we have to be fair towards each other. Don't you agree? And everybody says, yeah, we agree. But we also have to deal with some powers that is in the human species.
Both in this film and in Force Majeure, the main event seems to trigger a lot of interesting behavioral patterns. Where does that interest originally come from?
I'm from an academic background. My parents were teachers, so I come from an academic home. And I remember, you know, my mother, she did like a test in her school that was like inspired of the Solomon Asch conformity test. I don't know if you know about that. And it's like you take out one individual out of a group and you ask, you have two lines and you are supposed to point on the longest line. And when this person that have been picked out points on the longest line, it's very clear which one is the longest line. Then the group is saying the opposite. They say, no, it's the short, that other one that is the longest line. And how quickly you create an insecureness in that individual. And she did this test with kids that were in third grade. So they were 9 years old. And I thought it was like, oh my God, how can she do that? But when my family, when we were discussing things, we were always putting people's behavior into a context, not putting guilt on the individual, but rather talk about why do we behave as we behave. So I think it's a lot about my upbringing.
Ruben Ostlund talking to Gaia Lutz there, and The Square is out now, and you are tuned in to The Monocle Weekly.
Tonight, the Juno Awards take place in Vancouver. The ceremony is known as the Canadian Grammys, but Canada more than punches its weight on the global stage.
Up for awards tonight are superstars such as The Weeknd and Arcade Fire, and lesser-known talents such as Amelia Curran and Daniel Caesar. And joining us on the line from Vancouver to tell us more is the radio DJ and the music journalist, Lana Gay. Lana, welcome to the programme. Are you excited? Are you primed? Do you have a pre-match ritual for the Junos?
Oh, wow. Yes, I'm excited. Michael Bublé is the host, so I'm equally excited. Excited because I'm part of Juno TV this year, so I'm interviewing all of the people who are performing on stage via the live stream. So I'll be watching parts of the show while I'm kind of doing my thing. So I'm going to probably watch it all after the fact.
But being in the thick of the action is kind of where you want to be, right? Because the Junos, I've seen parts of it, I've seen watched parts of it on YouTube, and I understand it's not po-faced and sort of political and kind of trying to show that it's really kind of right on, like the Grammys and like lots of other music awards. It's basically a really good, fun night, and it's a great kind of advert for the great difference in quality of Canada, isn't it?
Ooh, the difference in quality of Canada. That's interesting. The Junos are usually super fun as well. What people don't know often is that the Junos, they rotate. So I'm not sure, do the Brit Awards take place in different cities in the UK every year?
I don't know. I think it has. Maybe they sometimes have it in Manchester. Yeah. It's normally in London, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, because Canada is this like monstrous country full of wasteland, like it's so big with so few people. Every year, I think it's really important that the Junos have a whole party week called JunoFest leading up to the actual broadcast. And they rotate the location of the broadcast every year. So this year's in Vancouver, last year was in Ottawa. It's kind of cool because these big bands from all over the country, they're also playing smaller venues and doing like cool DJ sets and stuff throughout the week. So the different locations, people all around the country, usually via this rotation, kind of get the chance to experience Canadian music in that way as well.
Well, great. So, and Lana, it's interesting because obviously there are some real, you know, big headline Canadian artists who are truly, you know, it's not about sort of breaking the global market. They are the international stars. And it's interesting, maybe the Junos is kind of reflecting the new role of Canadian music, popular music certainly. This is going to be, anyone anywhere can watch this, right, online. It's not restricted by region as so many of these things are. Do you think that's an expression of how Canada's cracked the true global market in terms of really saleable artists?
Well, I think Canadian music has definitely been paid more attention to on the global scale with bands like, for example, Arcade Fire, nominated for 4 Junos. They're performing. They're also getting an amazing international achievement award for their work with Compay and Partners in Health, and just for being so amazing on an international scale. But this year, yeah, it's the first time, I believe, and I think it has something to do with broadcast partners, to be honest, but the first time it's going to be broadcast and streamed internationally. And I feel like there's so much attention on a variety of artists, even up-and-comer Daniel Caesar. He's incredible. His album is doing so well internationally. He's got a lot of focus. It's like this smooth, sexy R&B record. He's a great writer. And so I'm happy that, you know, on the same stage as Arcade Fire are Jessie Reyez and Diana Krall. You know what I mean? Like, we have such a diverse...
You've got quite a broad church there, right?
I love the British vernacular, broad church.
There's a wide diversity of different sorts of artists on the thing.
Absolutely.
The live show, does that kind of feel like, that feels like quite a celebration? All these people play live.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Actually, you know, one band to definitely watch who are always, you know, there's just bands that you see and you know for just going in, you're going to leave after the song and your cheeks are going to hurt because you're just smiling the whole performance. One of the great Canadian bands that is like that kind of a party band is Arkells. They're from Hamilton, Ontario. They're a super fun indie rock band. They'll have a horn section. Usually they have a couple surprises, but they're performing this year as well.
We've got a few cues lined up for music. You mentioned Daniel Caesar, Lana. Let's put a bit of meat on the bones for our listeners so they know what Daniel Caesar sounds like. This is something called Best Part.
You know that I see it. I know you're a star. Where you go, I'll follow. No matter how far. If life is a movie, oh, you're the best part. Oh, you're the best part.
Oh. Daniel Caesar's Best Part there. Is that kind of representative of Daniel's work? That's pretty good stuff. Kind of very smooth R&B gear there, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those records that you just like, you go, mmm, mmm, when you're listening to it.
Man, Lana's really making me like Daniel Caesar more than I thought I did already.
Lana, can I ask you a bit about how this fits in? You already mentioned how enormous Canada is. And do you really get this sort of sense of artists who are part of a local scene? You know, if you're talking about Daniel Caesar out of Toronto and other bands, you know, Bad Bad Not Goods, that are really sort of part of a moment and of a scene that comes from one particular place? Or are there truly kind of Canadian acts?
I mean, Canada is a very diverse place, and I feel like any big city, any big, or any country definitely has pockets and communities. So right now, I would say, you know, there's a really hotbed of R&B and hip hop and kind of soul coming from the Toronto area. But that's not to say that there isn't awesome hip hop and soul and R&B coming from Montreal as well. It just kind of depends where the focus is sometimes. And right now, I think there's a lot of focus on, you know, Charlotte Day Wilson, on Jesse Reyes, on Daniel Caesar, Claremont II. So, yeah. So, I mean, I feel like we're always going to be so excited to rep where we're from. In Vancouver, obviously, there's, you know, everyone's super stoked that even, you know, like that Michael Bublé is hosting. He's like a legend. And he's also hosting in, you know, home turf, which is beautiful. But yeah, I think that to kind of answer your question in a broad sense, the Canadian sound is very diverse. And though there are, you know, pockets and communities that are working together and getting a lot of spotlight, I think it's hard to pinpoint what, you know, a Canadian sound is, but we're all kind of just proud to be all together.
We've got Gord Downie on the list.
So Gord Downie, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Tragically Hip at all. The Tragically Hip are one of those bands that are completely woven into the fabric of Canada, and also one of those bands that never really truly made it outside of Canada. And it's strange because they're a group that could sell out, you know, three nights at one of the biggest venues in the entire country and sell it out in minutes. Yet if they crossed the border to America, would play to, you know, 25 people. Like, maybe not, maybe 250 people. But like, it's just, the Tragically Hip are such an important band. They have a career that spans 30 years. And Gord Downie, sadly, he died of brain cancer last year. And his kind of goodbye, because he knew that he was dying, was to put together this beautiful record, which was essentially, he wrote, I think it's 25 songs. And each song is like, it encapsulates a moment with a person in his life that he loves. And so he's nominated for, I do believe it's 3 Junos this year. And there's going to be a beautiful tribute. So if you're watching online, City in Color, a.k.a. Dallas Green, who you may also know from Alexis on Fire, he actually collaborated with Gord Downie probably about, I'd say maybe 7 years ago on a song called Sleeping Sickness. So he kind of collaborated with his hero and has this beautiful kind of memory of that. And then Sarah Harmer, who's from the Kingston area, which is where the Tragically Hip are from, they're going to do a duet in honor of Gord Downie. So that's something to pay attention to the broadcast for.
So we're going to play a little bit of the North then, Lana. So this is a sort of posthumous award or a posthumous nomination. This is Gord Downie with the North.
Over 100 years old, their parents without kids, without parents, without kids, without parents, without kids, without parents, without kids.
Familiar tones there of Gord Downie, that was the North. We're going to end with Tanya Tagaq. Lana, she's an interesting one. I'm sure I reviewed this record in Monocle. Is she not sort of a throat singer? She's got quite an interesting sound, is she not?
Yes. So she was raised in Nunavut, so in our North, going back to the North. She's an Indigenous artist, but she's experimental and she improvises. And so she incorporates traditional throat singing. And traditional throat singing is actually usually two women that kind of play this game with each other. So she's taken it and done it herself. And she's kind of incorporated her heritage into some really powerful, raw, and emotional, very intense music at times. And I truly believe if you have the chance to see her live, her ability to tell a story and evoke emotion is like probably no other performer I've ever seen. So sometimes audibly, if you're like, oh, like I want to introduce you to Tanya Tagaq, and you play a little bit, your friends might be like, what is going on
yeah,
here?
Yeah, what are you doing to me?
Yeah, this is pretty, what's happening? But she's absolutely a tremendous talent and such an artist to experience. So if she's ever in your neighborhood, she's one of the most memorable performers you will ever see.
You can't get a much better intro than that or a trailer head. So let's take a listen. This is Tanya Tagaq with Retribution.
Here.
Britney's changed. That was Tanya Tagak with Retribution. Yeah, it's pretty fierce stuff. I mean, it's a record that stood out a mile. I think that came out last year. I remember getting that in the magazine. Lana, that's amazing stuff. So she's playing live at the Junos tonight.
Yeah, I do believe she's nominated for Alternative Album of the Year. So I don't know if she's actually performing at the broadcast, but she's a nominee.
That's quite something. And is she, I don't know whether you know of her sort of status and stuff, but I was interested that she's sort of an Indigenous artist and interested in the politics and all the rest of it. And she's kind of got quite a lot of female politics in her album as well, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. She's an amazing artist on so many levels. I believe she's also a visual artist. She's a true force, and she's just incredible if you can follow her and just take a little bit more time. I feel like she's again, as you heard, it's a very complex track at times. But I mean, if you see her, it's almost like watching a one-woman metal show at times, where you're completely taken aback but invested. I've welled up with tears watching.
Lana, thank you so much for taking time out to speak to us today. Of all days, you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
Well, Rob, it's interesting, isn't it? We always talk on the Monocle Weekly, light and shade, learnings. There were Canadian learnings left and right. The august,
so
the venerable
good.
John Ralston Saul.
Yeah.
All the fun of the Canadian Grammys.
The Junos. Let's thank our listeners for tuning in. This was edition 455 of the Monocle Weekly, if you can believe it. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and Claire Urban.
Thanks to Tom Melville and Amber Roberts for their research, and thanks to our own Daniel Bache. Rob, you know he's from Canada as well.
The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.